restaurateurs and people in hospitality are being at the forefront of a lot of innovation. But because they have that authority, I think they should be using it more actively, more openly, more spontaneously, and with conviction, which they all do in the end, because everybody knows that if the ingredient is not good, there's no point putting it on a plate.
Today on Dirty Linen, we are talking to one of Australia's best-loved food identities. But I don't know, there is so much about Stefano De Pieri that we could say I do not even know where to start. He is a councillor in local government. He is a lover of the arts. He is an advocate for regional Australia and Mildura and the Murray-Darling in particular. And he has a new TV show coming up called Australia's Food Bowl, which is premiering on SBS at the end of May. Stefano, welcome.
A pleasure.
When you did your first show, A Gondola on the Murray, and the book that preceded it, it was around the turn of the century, which makes us all sound very old. but it was a bit of a revolution in the way that food was presented to the Australian public. There really hadn't been a show like that before. And now, you know, you're back celebrating that region. But I guess In the interim, so much has changed in food culture. So much has changed in our understanding of the environment and the way that our food systems interact with it. I mean, how are you feeling about everything?
Well, let me start from the beginning. The Gondola on the Murray was indeed rough and ready. We did it with very little money on the ABC, but it did strike a chord because we were presenting regional Australia to essentially to a metropolitan audience and to also to other regional audience. And people saw the regions catapulted onto their screen and they said, well, there isn't only Jamie Oliver or the two fat ladies or whatever at the time. We've got something to show as well. So it was mostly based on, you know, if you like, a bit of entertainment, a bit of fun, and a bit of the Italian heritage. But now things change quite dramatically in the sense that all those families have aged, they've gone. There's very little left of the traditional community structure of those days. Agriculture has become more... production has become somewhat more professionalized and corporatized. And with that comes some great results and some great challenges too. And one of the main challenge, of course, is the use of water. So without hectoring people or being screaming from the megaphone, you know, environmental politics, which is at the core of my belief system, but we, without being too strident, if you like, we just constantly refer to the importance of water and the importance of saving water and highlight how much is being produced with this water. Now, obviously, if you join your own dots, you will conclude that with climate change and over-extraction of water, if we're going at this rate, we will compromise our food, the integrity of our food system. This is never quite, you know, fully spelled out because it's TV and whatnot, but it is there. It's the elephant in the room.
I think you've always interwoven politics through everything that you've done. And it's really interesting to see that you're continuing to use soft power in this way. Because I think, you know, people are so much more, well, I feel like people in general are so much more aware of the way that water is used. Obviously, climate change has become a huge part of everybody's thinking, hopefully. And when people talk about the Murray-Darling Basin and the river systems, we do hear more about the commoditization of water, which even to say that seems so ridiculous, that something that seems so inherently there for the community could be bought and sold like a commodity. And we hear about, you know, foreign ownership of some water rights and issues associated with that. We hear about fish dying. We hear, you know, obviously the huge impact of cotton, yeah, did the choice of crops, and you know, the impact of drought, which of course, you know, is amplified by water being taken at various points along the way. So, I mean, it's really, I haven't seen the show, but I'm going to be so interested to see how you create some, you know, cheery entertainment, but, you know, get us around the side with some, yeah, turn us into activists.
Bear in mind, though, that, and I have to stress this, that we filmed during COVID. It was a battle uphill. We were denied a lot of access to content, obviously, that could have made the show perhaps a bit more varied. In the end, we selected to go with big chunks of things that are representative of some change or some innovation since my last TV, which was The Gondola, like, for instance, the emergence of a huge olive oil industry, extra virgin olive oil industry, I must add. 20 years ago, it was just at the beginning. And now it is, you know, I imagine you're a 20-year-old. You're going to a supermarket or some shop to buy your groceries, and you pick up a bottle of Australian olive oil nonchalantly without realizing that my generation had to go to the chemist to find olive oil.
Yes. Well, thank God that has changed. But you're right. It's so easy to take these things for granted. And when people take them for granted, then they probably don't value them as much as would be helpful.
Or for instance, we have a story which we focused on significantly on the substitution of Chinese garlic in every Australian supermarket by Nick Diamantopoulos, which is a story that you, Danny, could one day very well explore. It's just remarkable, remarkable.
Well, tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, as you know, Australian supermarkets and other shops have always imported Chinese garlic, always, since time immemorial, because it was readily available cheap. And to grow Australian garlic on a large scale is very, very, very difficult. Until this man began experimenting and trialing and growing his stuff 20 years ago, and now has culminated in his capacity to provide fresh Australian garlic to almost every supermarket and every shop. It's an incredible achievement, and he probably has, you know, develop about 300 varieties, but he only markets probably 6 or 7. And he's spreading garlic right around not only this region where the processing takes place and where all the, if you like, this is the administrative center of the project. But he also grows it down the Chuka way, down Ballarat way, now into South Australia to try to end, and soon up in Alice Springs. With the Aboriginal community, because then he can bring garlic in much earlier in the season. So it's an extraordinary Australian achievement. And you'll see acres and acres and acres of the most stupendous garlic developed by this quirky character who's just pure fun, ingenuity and generosity. I'm so cheered up by that. And so these changes are taking place as you have, you know, small growers doing persimmon or pomegranates or jujubes, you know. So we're showing off a little bit of all of that and say, look, this is in your backyard.
It's great. I can't wait to see that. And it's so, I mean, yeah, it's wonderful to have local garlic in more widely available and available throughout the year. It's fantastic. I know that you talk about the Murray cod a lot. So can you tell us about tell us what you discovered about Murray cod?
When legislation prohibited the fishing, commercial fishing of cod, we were hoping that an industry would emerge, an aquaculture industry, and it has. And then again, you know, you wait with bated breath for the quality. Is it going to be muddy? Is it going to be tasty? And I must say the result is very, very good, very encouraging. So we are now able to to grow and use this resource without having to, without having to fish from the natural environment, because cod and perch and catfish are very much under stress, as you can imagine. Especially one of the things that probably will emerge from the show is when we go to the Darling River and explain that the Darling River, scientists have discovered, is the incubator of all fin fish, all native fish. It's the Darling, from Menindee to Mildura. And that's a fact that the authorities have not wanted to highlight. And it was the real tragedy when you saw the fish going belly up and dying, because are you there?
Yeah,
they're all those dead fish. They're the mothers and father of the fish that then, with a flood, with pulses of water, then all these fish leaks are distributed right through the basin. Do you understand?
Yeah.
And because they've got the technology now to have a look at the little bone inside the head of the fish, they can tell you how old it is and where it's been. They can tell you where the fish has been. So now we know. And, you know, this decision by the New South Wales authorities to shut the Darling from Bourke to Mildura by shutting down the Menindee Lake system in order to keep water in the north for cotton is a disastrous thing. It's one of the great scandals of Australian history.
I just feel like so much of what's going on with our water is a great scandal.
It is. And there lies the contradiction. Without it, we can't have the food. But the way it's over-extracted, especially for fibre, that is silly. And one of the other things is, you know, we cannot allow the continuing expansion of large investments like almonds. We all love the almonds. I'm the first to love them. I dedicated a section of the show to the almond, but we have to be aware that it's when you have one single almond, you are intaking 4 liters of water.
Almonds just drive me a bit crazy because so many of them are now produced for almond milk. They take so much water to produce, and then they get mixed with water again to turn them into the milk. It's just so crazy.
There is a bizarre kind of thing going on there. And whilst the TV program sort of alludes to these things, it is important that us who operate in this environment are clear about the consequences of what's happening. I think that unfortunately a lot of our colleagues and chefs and writers and so on have not linked sufficiently the future of food to the environmental issues. We always talk about the dish itself, the art, the flavor, the novelty, the fact that somebody has now invented something new or turned another culinary stone, discovering some other exotic ingredient or methodology, but we are failing to engage with consumers over this issue of water, climate change, and environment in general, and loss of biodiversity.
Yeah, I mean, look, every day it feels like there's another disaster, you know, that we're in the midst of, or another expression of the same disaster. I mean, it's really interesting, Stefano, because if we look back at the way that your food came to, you know, Australia's attention, and the way that, you know, you cooked at your restaurant, Stefano's in Mildura in the Grand Hotel, which is just a real game changer for regional restaurants. In its, I mean, the food, you know, when I went there, the food was so beautiful, but there was also a real humility at the heart of it. And if I think about, you know, the Italian cooking that you showed us, it was really steeped in that those humble Italian traditions where there is that connection to seasons and the landscape, and there is this sense of continuity, not this, as you say, this you know, high wire act of cuisine as performance, disconnected from context, more about, I don't know, theatre and show, and that's fun, but, you know, what does it all mean, and where are we going with it? I mean, damn it. Oh, you're back? Hello? Oh, okay, sorry, I lost you for a minute. So yeah, we have this sense of these two, I guess, strands of cuisine, this humble strand and this high wire trapeze act strand. I mean, do you feel like it's about is it a return? Is it the future? I mean, how do you think about that?
Look, I think that the two strands are not mutually exclusive, because food represents traditions on the one hand and innovation on the other, and the two walk parallel lines. Otherwise, you look at art, you know, you go from Raphael to the Baroque, from the Baroque to Cubism, to the abstract, to whatever. You know, things never stay still. But it's nice to know that, on the other hand, you can always rely on the simplicity and reliability of certain cuisines, which is steeped in time and practice and tradition. So, you know, you eat one day and the other another day, or one generates comfort, the other generates a sense of wonderment and immense possibilities, especially when it works, and human ingenuity, you know. So the two have to walk hand in hand. And I suppose that being a cook and not one of these mega creative chefs, I feel comfortable to be in my food bowl doing the simple things that give pleasure every day and don't really need to bust the wallet, as it were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what responsibility do you think chefs and restaurateurs have to communicate the interconnectedness of you know, what's on the menu with food systems? I mean, do you think they have a responsibility at all, or do you think it's up to consumers to go to restaurants?
No, I think we're all in it together, Danny. We're all in together. And I think that the chefs and so on have a huge role in front of our staff too. They have a huge role in being advocate for a better world, and be advocate for a better world daily. What a better way to live than to have a sense of mission when you get up in the morning and say, not only I have to put some money in the till and make sure we employ people and pay them properly. We've seen some pretty unsavory things in the past, but now, you know, we can draw the link between different things and highlight the good and criticize the bad. And, I mean, we've done a lot. You know, the whole organic thing has probably started in the kitchens. It didn't start in Woolworths. Then it goes to Woolworths and Coles, but initially it comes from a few pioneers, doesn't it? And so in many ways, restaurateurs and people in hospitality have been at the forefront of a lot of innovation. But because they have that authority, I think they should be using it more actively, more openly, more spontaneously, and with conviction, which they all do in the end, because everybody knows that if the ingredient is no good, there's no point putting it on a plate.
Yeah, and I think when you do get up in the morning with that sense of purpose, you got to have to carry it through till you go back to bed in the evening, aren't you?
Yes, but I tell you what, having a sense of purpose is, you know, is very rewarding, and it does a great deal for, at least for me, for my stability, for my mental health. I always know that going to a greater cause makes me feel better than, you know, than I start dwelling on my own inadequacy.
When we think about, you know, traditions in Australia and things that we can do better, you obviously we think of Indigenous Australians and, you know, foodways that have been destroyed and damaged or disrespected. How do you engage with Indigenous Australia in this new show and in the way that you work with food?
A little bit. It was quite difficult to find the right fit because of the COVID. And, you know, this community is very exposed we had to be we had to be full of precautions.
Sure.
And so that's one, regretfully, one part that wasn't particularly well dealt with, but hopefully in the future. I must say that here in this part of the world, there isn't yet a huge engagement with, but I did put on two young mothers who used to work for me. I'm very proud that I trained Tamara and the two moms that will appear on the show. And also Tamara's father appears and he talks about the cod and the history of the river. So we did do a little bit, but we didn't have a great deal of access.
Okay. Yeah. Stefano, you were involved in politics before you were involved in food in a professional sense, and you're you're on the council now. What are the issues that you're focusing on?
Well, councils, you know, bread and butter, and in a lot of the bread and butter stuff, like rubbish collections and so on, occupy and planning. Planning matters, they occupied a great deal of time. But I suppose that beyond that, we have declared a climate emergency. We're looking at gender equity and we're looking at redressing the cultural aspect. Like Mildura hasn't had a history written since 1938. So, you know, when there isn't a record, a publicly available record of the evolution of this community, since then, and even that which was produced in 1938 was very partial. You know, it was a history of the colonization of Mildura, not a history of deep time to the present. So we are, you know, little projects like that, and the development of our riverfront with more cultural assets there. So with my part is to promote the make visible the richness and the wealth of the Mildura history. We were once upon a time the sculpture capital of Australia. For 30 years, we dominated every expression of sculpture. This was an amazing workshop, far flung in the middle of a small rural community. Anybody who was anybody came here to make sculpture. Did you know that?
I had absolutely no idea about that. Is that just because one person set up some incredible studio and everyone had to go there? Or what happened?
Because there was an extraordinary gallery. The history of the gallery itself was established deserves another chapter. But suffice to say that the one of the directors of the gallery said, great, we have a gallery with an immense collection left to us by a philanthropist, but what are we going to do now? I mean, that's static. That's museum-like. He wanted to do something that was more interactive, so he began inviting artists to come and use the riverfront, paddocks, shops, abandoned shops, whatever. And there was a lot of ephemeral sculpture and solid, lasting works from Inga King to many, many, many. I mean, I don't know if you're old enough to remember the Yellow Peril in the city.
Oh, yeah, I remember, yeah. Yeah.
Well, the prototype was called Beethoven. It's sitting now in front of the Art Center. It's a green sculpture, a set of intersecting planes that looks nondescript. But if you look carefully, it was very innovative at the time. And then Robert Sud Swan went on and made the Yellow Peril that made the Herald Runner a fierce campaign against it for months on end, engaging with new varieties in 30 years. But hardly anyone knows that.
No, well, yeah. I certainly didn't know that, but I do remember the Yellow Peril. I think I was a kid. I can't remember how old, but yeah, there was this bright yellow sculpture.
That is still there next to Acca.
Yeah. So anyone can go and see it next to Acca now. But it was in the city square, which now is a building site for the Metro Tunnel. But it was. I was just thinking back on it. It's so funny to think about how up in arms people were about, you know, this offensive series of planes. I suppose, you know, we had a similar response to Federation Square, which, you know, now is part of the fabric of the city.
We always react like children, you know. We say, nyeh, 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 nyeh. It's just so silly the way we react to, but I suppose that's part of the evolution.
Yeah, I don't know where we're going with that one, but yeah, I don't know where we're evolving.
Last week they sold at auction the drawings for the Yellow Peril, and they thought they were going to get $15,000. It got to $50,000 just for the drawings of that particular. Yeah, so things move in mysterious ways.
They certainly do. So I'd love to learn, I mean, you mentioned that COVID really affected the filming of Australia's Food Bowl, but was it, I mean, here from my perspective in Melbourne, I remember seeing Mildura on the news and, you know, just people thinking it was a little bit ridiculous that you were subject to some of the same restrictions as we were in the city at times. So, yeah, tell me about what it was like through 2020 for Mildura.
Well, first of all, we didn't have a single case, but we, of course, had applied to us all the restrictions that were common in Melbourne. In fact, at some stage, we sort of complained to the Premier quite bitterly and said, look, you have to keep your wall around the city, but let us move freely because there is nothing wrong here. But with that said, you know, who knew? We were expecting the worst. The hospital here was prepared for an avalanche of cases. In reality, nothing went wrong. But, you know, I had a crew from Sydney, and just for them just to simply find the opportune time to cross the border was a difficulty.
I bet it was. Yeah.
So you had to get permits, and then sometimes it would be unexpectedly shut again and they couldn't come. So it was, you know, it took a year rather than 6 months. And it was very expensive. It was because when you can't work in a linear fashion, you know, it's like reinventing the wheel every time. And, so it was, and we wanted to tell the story, for instance, of our tomatoes, how the water that comes out of tomato can be purified and bottled. It was a quirky little story. We couldn't do that. We couldn't do a lot of the stuff that still happens in the Italian families, which would have had a little touch of the old gondola, not a lot. But again, we missed out on all of that. Mm. We missed out a little bit on more human contact. Sometimes you see me talking to someone and I am at the mandatory 1.5 meters away. You know?
Okay, right.
So, hey, how are you going? You're waving to somebody who's just, you know, over there. You say, why is he over there?
I guess there's going to be a lot of things that we look back on and they'll be dated with that distance.
Yeah, indeed.
What's it been like there since everything reopened and people from the cities and other states were allowed to travel to Mildura?
It's extraordinary. And we have people that normally go to other parts of the world, even, you know, people with the ability to spend. And we can't find staff. So if anyone's listening, we can't find staff, particularly in wine. And, you know, we need more people out here to know how to sell a bottle of wine and tell a story. And especially here in this region, and you probably know that since the Chalmers established the nursery, everyone has been buying new varieties. And they've entered every restaurant and wine bars of Australia has had the experience of, you know, engaging with new varieties. And now we're even producing stuff of huge quality here because the new varieties and different ways of handling it is actually lifting this region out of that bad name that we've always had for being, you know, big commercial things. But we need people to come and help us.
Well, you know what, Stefano, one of the big, I mean, everyone in the regions, everybody is talking about staff. One thing that I've heard in the regions is that looking for the staff is the first problem, but finding housing for them is the next. Have you got rooms for these people that you want to come up and sell wine?
I'll make my house available. I'll do anything. I'll find them the accommodation. But because we just need, I mean, if I had two people on the floor, I could increase my business by 10 or 15%. But not only that, I can give a better service than I can at the moment. You know, at the moment, I have to limit my bookings. I say, I either do a shit job or I limit the bookings.
I mean,
and I choose the second.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got to preserve your reputation, but it's so frustrating that people are not able to regain lost ground and forge on with their businesses because there aren't the staff. Mm-hmm. I mean, were you relying a lot on travelers, backpackers?
Of course. Yeah. Always had a small amount of backpackers who took us over the line.
It's so frustrating because exactly a year ago, you know, we were all looking at, you know, the way JobKeeper was implemented, the way that the messaging that we were getting from the federal government about if you couldn't look after yourself, go home. It was so foreseeable that we would be in this situation. And now here we are, you can't rebuild your business.
Mm. Well, the business, the opportunity is there. It's to avail yourself and to actually deliver, you know, you get people who come in and say, what Barolo have you got? That never happened before, although I've always had a very good list. And you know, so you have my member of staff scrambling up to me and say, the customer wants Barolo, go and help them, you know, I can help. But, you know, if I'm not there one night, I feel like, shit. What's going to happen? I mean, I do have another person there who is very qualified, but we could do with more. But not just me, it's across the board.
It's absolutely. Yeah, it's industry-wide. I mean, I think because, of course, it's getting that sale and looking after that customer, but it's Barolo, you know, you want to honour the wine as well and you know, the grand stories behind that.
Yeah, of course. And there are many different Barolos, as you know. You know, And age is a factor, so you have to talk about it. But also this revolution now that is happening here with the new varieties, you do know that one of my proudest moments perhaps is, you know, not gondola that said to people, well, regions have a function, please recognize them. And the second thing was new varieties have a role in the Australian drinking firmament because you can't just drink Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc and bloody Shiraz the whole time. And so now we've got this huge variety that intersects with skin contact, with all that sort of stuff. And it's just magnificent what we've done. We did it from here with the help of Tim White, Max, the whole lot of you, and all these hundreds of somms that have come through the last 21 years of the Alternative Varieties Wine Show. It's been amazing what we've done collectively. Right. Collectively.
So, yeah, just to expand on that a little bit more. So you started the Alternative Varieties Wine Show. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, well, we when the Chalmers family decided to embark on the importation of Italian and varieties, they needed an instrument to demonstrate the validity of this exercise. And so we began, for the first 2 years, we just did an arbitrary dinner based on Sangiovese because people didn't know what Sangiovese was. They thought of Chianti, but they didn't know what was behind it. And so we began a conversation through the Sangiovese challenge. And then slowly but surely, a lot of stuff started to be produced. And by the fourth or fifth year, we were up to 50, 60 entries of locally grown and locally made new varieties. And now we have graduated Pinot Grigio out. The next will be Prosecco to go out and maybe something else, because we're getting hundreds upon hundreds of entries that we can't handle anymore.
Wow. So, what a transformation.
Well, but you think about it. When was the first Pinot Grigio produced? It was Tig Alland on a small scale. And then it just became a supermarket line.
Yeah, that's so interesting how things change.
So rapidly, so rapidly. And now people talk to me, they come in, an ordinary punter said, oh, have you got any Nero d'Avola?
Love it.
They say Nero d'Avola. I say it's not the devil, it's d'Avola, the city inns. But never mind. Yes, I do have it. Which version would you like? And so on. And people now are curious. They're curious. They allow themselves, and the younger generation especially, they're not stuck like baby boomers on Shiraz and Chardonnay. It's all horizontal for them. It could be this, could be that, could be something. It's not, you know, there's not a vertical hierarchy of stuff. Barossa on top and everything else can't be.
Yeah.
It's across the board. Young people now have an open mind.
Well, you know, it's like it makes me think of, you know, Spotify and the way that people can listen to music, where it's just like from song to song, it's all on the same plane. It's not it's not that there's less context perhaps, but there's more open-mindedness and you can be thrown into any new experience.
And then that creates the context in time. It creates context. And it has created, I think, an association of food and wine that's much more sophisticated than it used to be.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Mm. I'm going to need to ponder that one, Stefano. But have you ever thought of going into federal politics and just sorting a few things out?
No, but I may consider going into state politics.
Yeah.
I may, because, again, for... you know, I'm 66, and if I don't do it soon, I'll never do it again. I may have a go, but it's mostly to talk about the regions. You know, I've got this bugbear that as soon as COVID is resolved, which will ever will be resolved, the metropolis will abandon us again. And yet we are the one who provides you with the snow, with the water for skiing, with the food and the wine. And we want a better engagement with the city and with the polity than we have had so far. We've always had to scream to get something done, particularly on the environment. And now it's time to join the city and the country. I am working with, I wanted to invite you over. I always think of you, I must say. I'm now the patron of the Postcolonial Institute in Institute of Studies in North Melbourne. But we've embarked on a project called The Future of Food. We want to understand where this is going and the implication of city and country, not just as a matter, it's a very important economic and cultural thing. It's a defining issue of our times. Where are you going to get the food from? And how are you going to protect those sources of food? And do you really want to export all the food that we export? What for? Sacrificing our resources in order to feed, what, a few Chinese middle-class people? You know, there's some really serious, serious, serious issues there.
Well, we're growing it with water that they own, so, you know.
Well, it's not that bad yet, but certainly we are exporting water all the time.
Is
there an ephemeral gain?
Yeah, well, they're such big questions, and I mean, they're the questions that we need to be asking. And it is it's ridiculous to think that there is a city-country divide because, of, as you say, you know, the resources of the country are what keep the city going. Unfortunately, it seems as our cities keep expanding, we also, you know, plonk houses onto arable land. Seems like a pretty bad idea. So, I mean, it's, yeah, as you say, we are all in it together. And if COVID taught us anything, surely it's that. So, yeah, well, I'd love to be part of it, any of those conversations. So, yeah, let's keep chatting. Yeah. It's been so wonderful to have you on the podcast today, Stefano. I love the breadth of your thinking and all the many strands that you draw together in all the different things that you do. I look forward to watching Australia's Food Bowl coming up on SBS. But thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat today.
A pleasure, Dani. Anytime.
Thank you.
This is Dirty Linen and I'm Dani Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about. We spend a week thrashing around each issue, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta at Dirty Linen Podcast. We can't wait to hear from you. This.